This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Carrie Goldberg. Our Week in Review begins today with Crime and Punishment.
For the first time in nearly a century, the Massachusetts House of Representatives expelled one of its members, Carlos Henriquez, convicted and imprisoned for domestic violence.
Although a jury found me guilty on two counts of assault and battery, it does not change my truth.
Also this week, computer glitches and healthcare reform. The state's Health Connector website gets a reboot.
The website that was supposed to make it easy for people to renew their coverage and transition from our state health reform to the federal reform law has not worked well enough.
And a task force recommends tightening the state's already tight gun laws.
40% of guns traced to crime in Massachusetts originate in Massachusetts. 60% of guns traced to crime come from out of state. So there's more we can do in this state.
And last week, he was shirtless on the front page of the Manchester Union Leader. This week, apologizing for renting out his email lists to a conservative website.
Is this any way for Scott Brown to begin a possible run for the Senate in the Granite State?
I do live in New Hampshire. I have for about a month now. My mom's there, my sisters, aunts, uncles, everybody. So it's a nice change, a little different, but very nice.
We'll dive into these stories and more with our Week in Review panel. Joining us now, former Boston City Councilor Mike Ross. And Mike, good to have you back.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me back.
Thanks for coming in. And Boston Globe columnist Joan Vinocchi joins us from the Boston Globe. Joan, great to have you back.
Same here.
So let's jump right in with the case of Carlos Henriquez. It took the House of Representatives on Beacon Hill just 90 minutes to debate his case. The Dorchester representative was convicted in January of two misdemeanor assault charges against a woman who refused to have sex with him, a conviction that also cost him his seat in the legislature. Here's House Ethics Committee Vice Chair David Nangle calling for his expulsion.
There is a great deal at stake here. The message our decision will send to the community organizations who work with the victims of domestic violence and the integrity of the Massachusetts House of Representatives.
For his part, Carlos Henriquez continued to claim his innocence.
The truth is, I never touched my accuser in any way at any point in time that would result in harm or injury. The truth is, domestic violence is far too prevalent, especially in my community, where women and children are often victims.
After those remarks, Henriquez returned to jail, and the House voted to expel him by a lopsided vote of 146-5. Joan, let me start with you on this. What do you make of this case of Carlos Henriquez?
I think the conviction changed everything for his colleagues in the House. It might not have changed the truth for him, but for them it did. It took it past he said, she said. And it also speaks to, I think, that we see kind of a tipping point now with domestic violence where they might have been, they probably didn't want to have to do this. They didn't want to expel a colleague, but where they might have found a way to forgive another conviction for another crime, they just couldn't do it here.
Mm. And Mike, let me come to you for your first your quick response to this case.
You know, I think people might have been a little bit affected by Carlos Henriquez's very strong defense, you know, very matter of fact, I didn't do this. But then I think people quickly realize that that's really not the question. And the fact of the matter is you've been convicted of this. And worst case scenario, you'll still be unavailable for your constituents for the next 6 months. And it just became clear that he couldn't serve. You know, the fact that he was brought into the state house in handcuffs at any point, I think, was over the top and not necessary as far as optics go around this. And, you know, he will pursue his defense however he does. And, you know, maybe one day there'll be a different outcome. But for today, I think the right decision was made here.
But let me ask you, is there any justifiable concern that the legislature overturn the will of the voters? I mean, not to make light of the crime in any way, but are there any constitutional issues at stake here that a legislature can basically say, you're out, and in spite of what the voters said?
You know, I have personal experience with this. I dealt with this when Councillor Chuck Turner was on the city council, and I was the president of the city council at the time. And he was convicted, and we then voted to move him off the council. Turned out, in fact, that that vote was an error, that the law didn't exist, that the foundation didn't exist for the Boston City Council to do that. It does exist for the state to do that. The state has the right to do that, as far as I read it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they did what they're entitled to do, and they've done it before. I mean, this wasn't the first case like this.
Joan, is that your reading of this, or do you think the State House will change, or does it have to adjust its rules in any way in the wake of this case?
I didn't mean to interrupt, Mike. I know they politicians know how to speak without taking a breath. technically, he was expelled because he didn't comply with a rule that, you know, saying that this might substantially impair the independence of his judgment. So I don't know. There might be, he might have grounds for saying that it was done improperly. And he can run again, and maybe his constituents will, you know, send him back to office. That's happened before.
So, Joan and Mike, let's move on to this week's story about the state healthcare connector. Governor Deval Patrick this week announced that the chief strategy officer at Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts, Sarah Islin, is being brought in to help fix the state's health connector website. It's been 4 months since the Massachusetts Health Connector website was retooled to meet the new federal rules under the Affordable Care Act, and it's been a big problem. The governor stressed yesterday that fixing the site is an issue of fairness.
We're not going to let anybody go without insurance. It's not going to happen. We have an obligation here that is an obligation in law, and we have a moral obligation and a commitment to doing so.
So, Mike, this has been a problem for a bunch of states around the country. The state has announced that it will stick with the firm CGI, which was hired to run the site. But the governor said the company will be on a quote-unquote shorter leash. So do you think, is there enough accountability here for what has been really a disastrous rollout, a debacle?
I mean, I think it says a lot of different things. One, first and foremost, I think it says that policy decisions cannot be made exclusive and separate from operational decisions around implementing them, around technology, around bringing in CIOs early into the process to get these things working. I think we saw that in the federal government. I think we saw that. We're seeing that here now. Second thing that's interesting is we didn't have any problems until the federal government's messy little website got involved with our website, which didn't have a problem before. And third, this is just going to cost us a tremendous amount of money, millions of dollars to fix it. Interestingly, the fixer company is the same company that's fixing the federal website as well.
Yeah, actually, I think that might be a good sign. But Joan, speaking of money, the state has also announced this new contract with Optum, the tech firm that Mike was just mentioning, which will be paid almost $10 million over the next month to help fix things with the Health Connector website. Now, that's about $500,000 per workday. Not that they'll only be working weekdays, but nonetheless, that's a lot of money to fix a website. How would you grade the governor's performance here?
Well, I was going to say this has shown us once again, told us a lot about Deval Patrick. First of all, it takes him so long to acknowledge when there's a problem. I think he finally did apologize yesterday, but his first line is to just say, call it a glitch. It almost mirrored what happened with the Obama administration. Mm-hmm. Rather than sort of take a lesson from what had happened in Washington, he just refused to acknowledge there was a problem, and then he finally does. And now the pressure is on to fix this at a great cost. But I don't think he has much of a choice at this point.
Mm-hmm. So let's move on to the problem of gun violence. And we were reminded today of just how serious this is. A 14-year-old boy in Mattapan apparently shot and killed his 9-year-old brother. That happened shortly before noon today, according to police. They apprehended the older brother still carrying the gun, called the shooting an apparent accident. Mayor Marty Walsh, himself the victim of gun violence, called it a tragedy.
I was not looking forward to this call. I knew this call would come someday as mayor of the city of Boston. I was hoping that it would never come, but I knew at some point I'd get this call. I didn't think I'd get this call today.
How come you knew you would get this call?
Because of the amount of guns on our streets, in particular neighborhoods. On top of that, we have to get the guns off the streets.
So Marty Walsh has made getting the guns off the street a priority in the early days of his administration. And this story, this awful story today, comes at the end of a week that began with a task force convened by the state legislature calling for tighter gun laws. The recommendations include tougher background checks, coordinating with national mental health records, better gun tracing, giving police chiefs more discretion to deny gun licenses, among many other other recommendations. Whether any of that would have prevented today's tragedy, not clear. But Joan, let me go to you first. What about these task force recommendations on guns? Are they likely to get approved? And do you think they could, if approved, make much of a difference?
Well, they ignored the most dramatic proposals that were before the task force. And I would just like to speak to what happened today. You said it was a terrible story, and it is. But by now, the one thing we know is that no matter how terrible the story, it doesn't change the two sides of the debate. So I don't see how what happened today, as awful as it is going to have much of an impact on what happens on Beacon Hill.
Hmm. And you say it doesn't change it because we've just seen this?
There will be people who will say, how did he get the gun? This young kid shouldn't have had the gun. It was probably obtained illegally. It came from out of state. That the laws that we have in Massachusetts can't stop that from happening. But that shouldn't interfere with a lawful right to have a weapon. And the debate just goes on and on in circles, and it doesn't seem to me that it matters. The collateral damage doesn't matter all that much.
Mike Ross, what's your view on this? You know, we heard John Rosenthal, head of Stop Handgun Violence, talking about the fact that 60% of guns come from out of state. It does seem like we do sort of talk around the edges of the problem here, and year after year after year, the problem of gun violence continues.
It does. I'm all for tougher gun laws here in Massachusetts, but the reality is that we're only as good as the gun laws of our surrounding communities. And so long as New Hampshire can easily get guns into the hands of people through the loopholes, through the gun shows, through second sales, et cetera, they will all matriculate, or many will matriculate into our communities. You know, I think in terms of this panel, they came up with some, I think they are coming off fair as in they're being fair. They actually rejected one of Deval Patrick's key proposals because they said they didn't think it worked. And I think having the courage to stand up and say, we actually want to go with other set of proposals shows that they're actually being deliberate and fair. And I think that's good, too. So,
Was the proposal that they rejected?
I think the one they rejected was the 1 month waiting period. They said this just really isn't going to help. Mm-hmm. This isn't going to save lives. Let's focus on the other things that can. And the other thing I'd say is don't underestimate the influence that the Newtown, Connecticut parents have had on this entire debate. I have seen them, their supporters, others who have been connected now to this issue from having seen what happened in Newtown show up at meetings now that were never in these meetings saying we now have to do something. People from suburbs are coming to meetings in Boston, sitting there and trying to figure out what can I do to fix this. Finally, I'd say the difference between, Marty Walsh's approach and Tom Menino's approach on gun violence, there's not going to be a lot, but one key difference was this gun buyback program. That was something that Menino wasn't doing, and it is something that Marty Walsh will be doing.
Mm. Joan, what about you? Do you see Marty Walsh's approach as appreciably different from the previous administrations in any way, in a way that might make a difference?
Well, Mike mentioned the buyback thing. He has a very human and personal way of connecting with these stories, but I think it's really too early to tell if it's going to lead to different policies. And I hope Mike is right about the impact from Newtown. And if those parents are going around, they certainly have the standing and the stature to make people pay attention. But so far, there hasn't been much that's happened as a result of it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really sad.
So let's talk next about Scott Brown, former Massachusetts senator, possible candidate for the U.S. Senate in New Hampshire. Brown talked with Fox News host Neil Cavuto this week about his move to the Granite State and his political future.
I do live in New Hampshire. I have for about a month now. Long and strong ties, Neil's in New Hampshire. My mom's there, my sisters, aunts, uncles, everybody. So it's a nice change, a little different, but very nice.
Yeah, you and Mitt Romney, Massachusetts, New Hampshire. I wonder if you're following in his steps. Is this eventually leading to a presidential run? What?
So, a little bit different size house, I will say.
Different size house. Yes, indeed. Joan, you wrote about Scott Brown this week, and you said, and I quote, "If Brown gets into the race, it's a big political story with potentially serious consequences for Democrats anxious to retain control of the U.S. Senate." Tell us about that. Why?
Well, look at the man takes off his shirt and it generates, you know, national press. No matter what he does, he like it or not, he's just kind of got that celebrity about him that at least makes the national media pay attention to him. Whether it translates into votes in New Hampshire, well, first he has to decide to get in or not. But he's already sort of proven that he can generate news. And he also is really good at retail politics. Look how he answered the Mitt Romney question. You know, he has a little joke about not as big a house, and he's really good at that.
Right. Mike, what do you make of Scott Brown and his political future? Do you think, can he sell New Hampshire voters on his candidacy should he choose to run?
Oh, absolutely. I think he's a threat in New Hampshire without a doubt. Mm-hmm. I think he'll be very successful there. But I have to tell you, the greatest bit of writing that occurred this week was Joan Vernocchi's first paragraph.
Joan, can you remember it?
What was it? It was beautiful. It was beautiful.
Well, I think it was just, you know, it's middle of winter. His shirt is off. He must be running for U.S. Senate. I mean, it wasn't that brilliant. I was just sort of stating the obvious. And I was a little bit disappointed that the Globe didn't run the photo.
Oh, yeah.
Shirtless.
God, how could you pass that up? I know. And Joan, what do you think? I mean, can he win in a race against the incumbent Senator Democrat Jeanne Shaheen?
Well, the last poll that came out showed him tied with Jeanne Shaheen. Obviously, it's too early to predict a winner. And I don't claim to be the expert on what's happening in New Hampshire at this very moment, but she does seem vulnerable. And just like when he ran against Martha Coakley, when Obamacare was, you know, front and center as an issue, it's still front and center as an issue, and they don't like it very much in New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. And she's kind of been called to task for different things that she said, and she seems a little vulnerable right now.
But is Scott Brown playing hard to get? I mean, Joan, has he come? I mean, do we even know? Has he declared his intention clearly?
No, he hasn't, right, and he can't be Hamlet forever in New Hampshire. He's got to decide, and I'm sure he'll be pressed to make a decision. Meanwhile, the Democrats seem nervous already, and they should be.
All right. Well, we've got time now for our hubbubs, those little stories that slipped below the fold, but perhaps not out of sight from our crack Week in Review team. Mike Ross, what's your hubbub for this week?
You know, can I do an audible? Because it just came up. I mean,
absolutely.
You know, I'm calling an audible. I read it this morning, and it just freaked me out. This story of, I mean, it's not funny, but it's horrible. It's this story of this woman who woke up to a raccoon on her, like, biting her face in the middle of the night.
Sounds like my cat.
It's in the Globe, yeah.
She got in, the cat, raccoon got in through the cat door.
Oh, boy.
And, I mean, it's just a horrible story. And this was a rabid raccoon. I mean, this is, like, one of the things that you, like, hope never happens to you. We woken up in the middle of the night to a rabid raccoon attached to your face biting you. It's a horrible.
It's a new
She's
phobia.
Okay. She's great. She's fine. Everything's, you know, but man, that was my hubbub. That shocked the heck out of me.
Wild times in the city. Joan, what's yours?
Well, I was just going to say, you could tell Mike lives in the city. When you live in the suburbs, you're used to all sorts of critters. And if you have cats, you know, they drag things in dead and alive. This was on page one of the New York Times, but it was below the fold.
All right. Well, we'll accept it then, Joan.
Okay. Beloved deaf composer in Japan appears to be none of the above. I was just kind of fascinated by the story, and I'm not going to try to pronounce his name because I'm sure I will massacre it, but he's apparently this beloved composer. He's a big celebrity. He's composed some of the famous works, and one of the Olympic skaters from Japan will be skating to it. And now it turns out a ghostwriter has come forward and said for like the past 15 or whatever years he's been the one writing it. And he also said that this guy may not even be hearing impaired. It was just such a story of deception. It was like sad. He had been a child prodigy and just one of these people that I guess couldn't deal with the fact of not being as talented as he once was, but it just kind of caught my attention.
Interesting.
Wild.
Carrie,
yeah.
How about you? How about your hubbub?
Okay, so my hubbub, so today, as you cannot help but know, the Olympics begin in Sochi. The opening ceremonies will be aired tonight, and then we're off and running or losing or ski jumping. And amid all the coverage of these heroic athletes overcoming these incredible odds, I have to say that my favorite story has been an article in the Boston Globe by David Filipov, who's a longtime Russia hand, and he got this great scoop. He beat the New York Times about how the Sochi authorities have been rounding up and killing hundreds of stray dogs, and animal rights activists have been trying to round dogs up and save them from the killers in these makeshift shelters. And it just smacked of the old Potemkin villages, you know, the fake villages that they would put up during the reign of Catherine the Great so that they could fool her when she came through. And I know, like, I'm not the first person to say that there's quite an element of Potemkin villages in the Olympic Village in Sochi, but this did seem to smack of that, that behind all these Russian accomplishments, there's also a dark, cruel side as well.
Well, here is my hubbub. It comes back a little closer to home from Sochi. It's about this really strange controversy at Wellesley College about this sculpture of a man clad only in his brief. It's a work by artist Tony Mattelli. And if you haven't seen it, it's a bronze. It's a painted bronze. It's supposed to be of a man sleepwalking, which is what it looks like. I got to say, honestly, I've been puzzled by the tumult and the controversy it's caused. There's been outrage, demands, even a petition to take the sculpture down. Why? Apparently, because it could trigger thoughts of sexual assault at the women's college. Now, I certainly don't want to make light of fears of sexual assault, but I'm not sure why a bronze of a human clad in briefs automatically triggers such thoughts. But the artist himself, Tony Mattelli, raises the question, isn't art supposed to be provocative? He says he's sympathetic with the concerns of the critics, but suggests that if they feel threatened by his sculpture, maybe they've got other problems. And he says he's never talked about a piece of his art so much and so thoroughly as this one. So that's where we will end our week in review. Mike Ross, former city councilor, attorney with Prince Lobel, and Boston Globe op-ed contributor. Thanks so much for coming in. Have a great weekend.
You too. Thank you.
And Joan Vanocki, columnist for the Boston Globe. Joan, always a pleasure. Have a great weekend.
Nice to be here. Thanks.
And stay with us. Coming up, why it may not be such a good idea to trust your gut. I'm Carrie Goldberg.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.